Okay, everybody's here. Thank you. Okay, welcome. Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan, Kansas. My name is Dave Lambert. I'll be the convener this morning. We are very fortunate to have David Carter here, who is the minister at the UU Fellowship down in Wichita. Today marks the first Sunday of our traveling minister show. John Alou, our normal minister, is in Wichita this morning, and David is here, and we will be sharing ministers with Wichita, Topeka, Lawrence, and of course Manhattan over the course of the next few months. So we welcome David here this morning, and we hope that we can all benefit from his words. David will speak to the building of community, centered on one of this country's more horrific legacies, that of marginalizing our citizens. As you use, we affirm the seven principles, and I think today we're speaking primarily to the first principle, in which we affirm the worth and the dignity of every person. So we welcome all of you. Welcome all of you to the UUFM, and we welcome Minister Carter. And at this moment, I would especially welcome any newcomers we might have in the congregation this morning. And should you care to, this isn't mandatory, but should you care to, please take a moment to stand, introduce yourselves, or if you have friends or relatives who have come with you this morning, this is a good opportunity to let us know who you are so we can zero in on you afterwards. So are there any new members this morning? Or are new visitors? Well, David is a new visitor. Okay. So the chalice lighting is one of the few traditions that we as UUs follow. The flame signifies many things to many people. But regardless of your own interpretation of this flame, we hope for all of you that it brings light to your search. Great. Okay, thank you. So please join us in our first opening song of We Are Climbing Jacob's Ladder. It's number 211 in the Gray Hymnal, and Renee Reisner will be following along on the piano.
We are climbing Jacob's ladder. We are climbing Jacob's ladder. We are climbing Jacob's ladder. We are climbing on. Every round goes higher, higher. Every round goes higher, higher. Every round goes higher.
This is the announcement portion of the program. But this Wednesday evening, October 28th, at the Flint Hills Room in the Student Union at the K-State campus, Charles Epp of the University of Kansas School of Public Affairs and Administration will be speaking to racial bias in police stops. The event is sponsored in part by this fellowship, and the event is in line with the resolution that we passed this past February, where we unanimously endorsed a report of the ACLU on disparities between white and black arrest records for the possession of marijuana. We affirmed, and this is a quote, The ACLU's conclusion that racial bias, whether conscious or unconscious, is the only creditable explanation behind the consistent and widespread racial disparities in marijuana possession arrest rates in the vast majority of counties in this country. John Extel, is John here? Oh, well, John was going to be here. John Extel was going to highlight this, but I think, oh, well, he just walked in the door. Good timing, John. Would you like to add the October 28th event? I've already spoken to the resolution that we passed in support of the ACLU report, and if you want to say anything more about Charles Epp.
Okay. Right now?
Yeah, right now. Good timing.
Well, I just want to kind of update you on what has happened since the resolution was passed here in February. So I'll just kind of give you a few broad brushstrokes on that. There is now a formal committee representing four established churches and civic groups in Manhattan that has taken on the name the Manhattan Riley County Coalition for Equal Justice, CEJ for short. It includes the First Congregational United Church of Christ, the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. I've been educated that we have to use that full name. The Kansas State University Black Student Union, and the Manhattan Alliance for Peace and Justice. And there's a representative from each of those groups, including John Lou Johnstone, who's joined us. And then also, finally, a faculty member from the Department of in Criminology at K-State, Jeremy Briggs. There's also a lot of people who are supporters, but aren't formally representing an organization, such as Reverend Rachel Williams Glenn, the African-American pastor of the Bethel AME Church in Manhattan. So we've done basically three things since February. We've done a survey, a new study, I should say, following up on the American Civil Liberties Union report that we presented to the UU back in February, which showed a nearly 3-to-1 racial disparity in arrests for marijuana in Riley County. And our new study, to our surprise, in effect was a shocking discovery, our new study shows that things have gotten worse, and that racial disparity has climbed from 2.8% in 2010 to 4.2% now in 2013, the last year for which there's any data on this. That is represents a 50% increase in the racial disparity in Riley County in marijuana possession arrests. And the actual number of arrests has skyrocketed, you might say. It's increased by 250% in the space of 3 years. We don't know why. We don't know yet why that would, but that can't be just an accident. Nothing, that cannot simply be the result of individual policemen deciding to become more energetic. It suggests something of a policy, I would think, to explain that sudden steep increase. So that's one of our undertakings. We've also been doing a survey of the Yuma Street neighborhood in Manhattan, which has a high number of African Americans residents in it. And we're sponsoring now this lecture by Charles Epp, Racial Bias in Police Stops. So I just want to, I don't know how much you said about him, but just so you know, his new book, Pulled Over, Police Stops Define, how Police Stops Define Race and Citizenship, will, I think, shed light on why these racial disparities in arrest rates are occurring all over the country, including Riley County. So we think a heavy turnout at the Charles Epp Lecture this Wednesday, 7 o'clock in the K-State Union, what's the name, what's the room that, Flint Hills room, is really important. And so we urge you to be there, because we have asked the Riley County Police Department to have a representative there, the Manhattan Mercury, the City Commission, the Riley County Law Board, and so on. And the Manhattan Mercury hopefully will be covering it. So we've asked them, we've asked everybody to be there and fill up the room so that they know that this is an issue that we take very, very seriously. BSU has canceled its normal Tuesday meeting and has asked its members to attend on Wednesday of this week. And so we hope to fill up that room on Wednesday, and I strongly urge you to give us your support by being there, and that would be a very important to us. So I think that's basically everything, and thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you, John, and for the announcement and for all the work. One thing that did strike me during John's presentation was I would suggest getting there early, because seats are at a premium in the Flint Hills room. Let's see. So I believe John walked off with my program. I don't see Stefan and Kelly here. Oh, there they are. Okay. So we want to bring special attention to Stefan this morning, and to Kelly and the kids, of course, but to Stefan, because this is his last Sunday joining us in the fellowship. Stefan is going to be deployed to Kuwait with his unit this coming week. And we look forward to Stefan's safe return to the fellowship, to the success of their mission in Kuwait, and to Stefan's success in petitioning the Army so that he might pursue his ministry. We also want to welcome Kelly and the kids as members of this congregation, members of this fellowship, and to know that you are part of this community, and we will do all that we can during Stefan's absence to make you feel a part of this community.
We already have. Thank you.
Okay. So would anybody care to... We are now at the joys and concerns. Would anybody else care to mention a joy or concern? I guess Mark will be walking around with the microphone to broadcast.
Well, let me start then. In an effort to identify ourselves as viewers Wednesday, I may recommend that people wear their name tag there, and unless there's some taboo against that. We struggle for that. We struggle to be identified as Unitarian Universalists, and it's important that we are, I think. So I plan to.
Yeah, thank you, Mark. And I have a purple T-shirt that says UU on it. I don't know if anybody else has one of those or not, but I'm giving some thought to wearing the purple T-shirt.
Most of you, Christopher Renner, most of you know that this week John Carlin, the husband of Sidney Carlin, died. John did a lot in this community. He was very involved in addressing the needs of the poor and the downtrodden. He often brought those voices to places that made people somewhat uncomfortable when he was talking about some of the issues of poverty in this town. So I just think we should keep John in mind. Sydney's a good friend to us. She has stood strong against some very horrible politicians in Topeka on principles and issues that are dear to our hearts. And the funeral will be, I believe, later this week. I haven't heard exactly when, but Friday.
My name is Stefan, and I want, as a joy and a sorrow, yes, I am going to be leaving tomorrow morning at around 8:30. So my joy and sorrow is that my sorrow is that I'm leaving, and I will be gone for 9 months from my family and my UU family. But my joy is that I know that I'm leaving her in good hands, them in good hands, and thank you for your support, guys.
I'm Sylvia Beeman. I wanted to thank those who showed up for our work morning, actually. And so John Lou came, and Chris Bailey, the whole Campbell family met Jen, Kate, and June. Elka Lorenz, Ann Marchin, Wayne Clark generously loaned his truck and paid for all the gravel to fix the parking lot. Kalina Stanton, Jennifer Bryan, and Dick Beeman. And thank you, and our grounds are so wonderful. If anyone wants to contribute at a time that's not work morning, just please contact me or Mark Mayfield, who's building, and because I know everyone can't come on that specific day, there are always things that need to be done. Thanks.
Thank you for sharing those joys and those concerns. I especially appreciate Chris mentioning John's passing this past week. The children's story, or story for all ages, was suggested by David Carter. It's a story of Henry's Freedom Box, which our library actually does have. So I was able to check it out in the library and read it beforehand. But I noticed in the first page that this book was donated to the Manhattan Public Library by John and Sidney Carlin many years ago. So John continues to have a major influence on our congregation, John and Sidney both. So if the children would like to come forward, I will read the book that was donated by John and Sidney. It looks like we are on here. This is a story about a fellow named Henry Brown. And there's a picture of Henry when he was a boy. And this is a story about him growing from boyhood to young manhood. But he wasn't sure how old he was. He and his family were all slaves in the southern United States before the Civil War. And slaves weren't allowed to know when they were born or when their birthdays were. So he doesn't know how old he was. Henry was somewhat lucky in that, as far as it goes, he had an owner who let him work in the house as opposed to out in the fields. So he and his family all were house slaves as opposed to field slaves. But as his mother told him one day, that just like the winds can move the leaves around on the trees, as they do this time of year, the winds of change can affect their situation. And that's what happened to Henry and his family. Henry's owner took ill, and he passed away. And unfortunately, Henry was bequeathed, given away to his master's son. And his son was not as nice as the original owner, and put Henry to work in a factory. So Henry went to work in his son's factory, had a very, very horrible situation there where if he didn't roll the tobacco just right, he was beaten. But he wasn't the only one working in that factory. One of the nice things that Henry was able to do was he fell in love. He fell in love with a woman named Nancy, and fortunately, Nancy fell in love with him. And both of their owners gave them permission to be married, which was also one of the requirements of slaves in those days, that the owners of both parties had to agree to give their permission for a marriage. So Nancy and Henry were married, and over the course of time, they had three children. And they lived in their own house, and it was not that bad a situation, even though they were owned by their masters. Unfortunately, Nancy's owner made some very bad business decisions and was running out of money. So she was afraid that her owner was going to sell, which was perfectly permissible at the time, sell her and the children to another owner. This made Henry very, very sad to contemplate what would happen. Well, while Henry was at work one day, his good friend James whispered into his ear, "It's happened. Your wife and your children have been sold, and they must leave our city." So Henry quickly, at lunchtime, when he could leave the factory, ran downtown just in time to see his children being driven away and Nancy, his wife, also being driven away in a carriage to their new owner, never to be seen again. No, we aren't done yet. Naturally, this made Henry very, very sad to have his wife and his children torn away from him. At this point, Henry was saddened by his wife and his children moving away, being driven away, and he began to question the entire concept that one person can own another person. So Henry, who's still don't know how old he is, but was a young man at this point, he and his friend James contacted a Dr. Smith who lived in their town, who was also opposed to slavery, and contemplated what could they do to end the slavery that Henry is living under. Well, Henry had an idea. "How about," he said, "I build a large box," which I think is in the picture. "I build a large box, I hide in the box, and we mail the box somewhere. We mail the box to a city where slavery does not exist." And that was his idea, and Dr. Smith had no problems with that idea, and his friend James had no problems with that idea. So that's what they did. So they made a large box. Henry was to hide in the box, and Dr. Smith wrote upon the box, "Please handle with care, because there's going to be a person inside." And he also wrote this end up, and just like you guys have probably discovered with FedEx and UPS, the people who move these boxes around don't pay any attention to what you write on the outside of the box. So, unfortunately, Henry did hide in the box. It was mailed to a city where slavery did not exist, but it wasn't a very comfortable trip. So he started out in a train in his own city, and as you can see in the picture there, it was correctly, this side was up, so he was comfortable. But when he got on the ship, which was the next stage of the journey, he was upside down. They just threw the box on the ship, upside down. So the poor guy was upside down for quite a few hours. And then some people came along and moved the box around, and he was upside down in this picture. And then he was on his right side, and then he was on his left side, and finally they put the box right side up. They didn't know he was inside it, but they just happened to pick the right situation for him. So the rest of the trip, he was right side up. It was very painful to be upside down on the ship. After 27 hours in his box, and 350 miles, which is quite a distance, especially if you have to travel by wagon and by railroad and by steamship and again by railroad. After 350 miles, he arrived in Philadelphia, which is where slavery was not allowed. They opened the box at Dr. Smith's friends' houses, and Henry jumped out and said, "Here I am. I'm in a free state. I'm in a free city, and I am no longer a slave." So he marks that day, March 30th of 1847, I believe it was, as his birthday. From that day on, he lived as a free man. So he was successful in mailing himself to freedom. So, go now in peace.
May hearts go with you. Go in love, may our hearts go. Go with you, go in joy.
So we ask you now to share your blessings with those who will benefit from the blessing. Thank you, Renee. And even though we have a policy of not applauding at the piano, know that internally we are all just applauding like crazy. There was an article in yesterday's New York Times, which I thought was very timely, as I was preparing to be this morning's convener. But the article was the disproportionate risk of driving while black. It seems to hit upon the subject of Charles Epps' talk next Wednesday evening, as well as David Carter's sermon this morning. The analysis focuses on traffic stops in Greensboro, North Carolina, focusing on Greensboro because they do have fairly extensive records in that city. There are very few jurisdictions in the country that have such good records on traffic stops. But the analysis did find that police stopped African-American drivers at a rate far out of proportion to their share of the driving population in that southern city. In Greensboro, blacks are four times more likely to be arrested on charges of resisting, obstructing, or delaying a policeman. As you probably can tell, these are arrest charges extremely open to subjective interpretation. Police organizations, some of them, offer the defense that traffic or pedestrian stops are proactive policing. But the director of the U.S. Justice Department's Office of Community-Oriented Policing Services, himself a former police chief in California, questions the existence of any benefits to such proactive policing. One of the young men subject to an unprovoked assault by the Greensboro police in 2013 was quoted in this article as saying, "Whenever one of them is near, I don't feel comfortable. I don't feel safe." This is around police people, police officers. This is a fear shared by many of us, but is especially strong among citizens of color in this country. So is there any hope? Those are the words that perhaps David will bring us this morning. So I welcome David Carter to our podium.
Thank you, Dave, and thank you, friends. It's really a joy to be here. It's the second time I've spoken from this pulpit. And I had the great joy to know Michael Nelson, and I'm very grateful for that knowledge that I have of the work that he's done with you and the support that you've given him. And I am looking forward to getting to know John Alou Johnstone as well. I'm going to present what I have to say first in a thesis form. It's so close to my heart, so much a part of my everyday experience, that I'm afraid if I don't do that, and I get impassioned as I speak, it won't rest in your hearts and minds the way I hope that what I have to share with you will. So I broke it into five different areas, the thesis. The first is that Black Lives Matter is a call to avert catastrophe. I'll unpack that as I speak, but that's one of my thesis points. This is an urgent call to avert catastrophe for America and the world. The second point is that the evidence that there is an urgent problem and a movement towards a catastrophic event or series of events is hiding in plain sight. I will unpack that as well. Third point, the persistence of denial of the urgency of this problem and the gravity of it is symptomatic of a pernicious disease that could be fatal to the American dream and the ideals of the best ideals of humanity. And then finally, those three sort of set the table for the last two parts of my thesis, which is number one, or number four in the series. The problem is not a material problem. It is a spiritual problem, and its answer is a spiritual answer. And lastly, Unitarian Universalists get it. Unitarian Universalists have gotten it, do get it, and will get it. And that's where I'm going finally. But let's go back and unpack the different points of the thesis. Picture a fellow in a tree, up high, sitting on a big limb of the tree, with a saw in his hand, sawing very industriously. And he's sawing closer to the trunk of the tree than he's sitting. Do you have the picture in your mind? Imagine a trickster character. He exists in every culture. The Irish call him Wee Jack. In Asia, the Indian people call him Gopal Bhan. But this trickster fellow is walking along the road and he sees, "Oh, hey, you! Fella, hey, what are you doing? Cut that out. Stop." And the man looks down. "Who asked you? Mind your own business." But if you keep doing that, "I said, who asked you? Mind your own business." So Wee Jack goes on. or Gopal Bhand, goes on. He goes walking on. And then there's a loud crashing sound, a huge thud, and the man lands on the ground. The branch hits him. He's dazed. He's stunned. He's unconscious for a moment. And then he jumps up and he says, "Wait, wait, you're some kind of prophet. You're some kind of saint. Wait, wait, I want to talk with you." It's no great revelation of prophetic genius to be able to tell that if you're sawing the branch nearer to the trunk than you're sitting, when you saw through it, you're going to fall perhaps to your death. When militarism reaches the level that it has in America, when pogroms are carried out against marginalized communities at the rate that pogroms are carried out and historically have been carried out against communities of people of color, these are evidences that we are at a danger point of losing the freedoms that called people to settle in America and to pronounce and articulate and elaborate ideals of human behavior that far exceed anything that had been in the past. There's a saying, to name it or to tame it, you must name it. Name it to tame it. What is the problem? What is it that we want to name in order to tame? The fact that to look as I look puts me at risk. As Dave just said, if I'm driving, I'm more at risk of being stopped. If I'm stopped, I'm more at risk of being treated with bellicosity and aggression. And if I'm ill-tempered or distracted, I'm much more at risk of being assaulted and battered and arrested, charged with a crime for driving while black or walking down the street while black. Black Lives Matter is articulated not to disparage the notion that all lives matter, but actually to say the important thing that ratifies the truth that all lives matter. I'll get to that a little bit later. So now the evidence is hiding in plain sight. I have a smartphone. It's charging up over there. Please don't let me forget it. I'm sure I won't. I use the GPS to get here without any events, because I'm a directionally impaired driver, and my GPS is a good friend. But among the other things that my cell phone can do is it can videotape and record the things that I witness. And I walk through the gardens daily in Botanica in Wichita to meditate. But many, many people have had occasion to take out their cell phones and record interactions between a police officer or several police officers or a pack of police officers and one or more black-bodied persons who we all have seen, I think we all have seen, get treated brutally, viciously, criminally, egregiously, shamefully. And then, when it goes viral, and the whole world is paying attention, we later see authorities come forward and exonerate the person who, as in the case of the police officer who killed Eric Garner for supposedly selling contraband, who used an illegal hold, a chokehold that was banned in New York for more than a decade, a crime to choke a person in that way. The man was videotaped choking the other man to death in that way, and he was excused of any criminal charges. He was not prosecuted. He was not removed from the force. Did we see one? Did we see two? Did we see five? Have we seen 30? One is enough. 10 is unbelievable. Sometimes we see that when the person is videotaping, that person is aggressively approached by the police, and we know that in some cases the instrument is taken away and the evidence is destroyed. And in other cases, the person who successfully records and distributes that information is sought out, persecuted, prosecuted, and penalized for exercising their free right to record the activities of policemen in broad broad daylight in public. So the evidence is there. We've seen it by virtue of modern technology, but it's not new. It's been going on for hundreds and hundreds of years in this country. So, like I said, I want to weave together some things. Maybe I'm foreshadowing a little bit. I'm not sure. I'm speaking rather extemporaneously. But my next point in the thesis is that denial indicates a very serious disease. You know, disease is stealthy. I've been diagnosed with cancer twice. The first time the treatment was very mild. It was ambulatory. I walked away from it. I had biopsies later and investigations for a number of years, and I was well with very little intervention. The second time, though, I had been anticipating that I might fall victim to prostate cancer. It killed my father. African-American males are more likely to get prostate cancer than their contemporaries who are not African-American. And if you have an ancestor who had it, you're more likely. So I was taking measures that I thought would prevent me from falling victim to that. I learned later that the measures I took, saw palmetto and pygium, masked the symptom, did not arrest the progress of the disease, and it had nearly metastasized throughout my body. I was very, very sick. And it wasn't clear in 2009 whether I'd survive the illness and then the three complications post-surgery. I did. But my point here, that little digression, is to say, we may look well, we may feel well, we may think that we are well, but stealthily disease may be eroding our health to the point where we become a deceased person that everybody mourns. This is how I see what is afoot now with America and the American dream. I read the New Yorker magazine. Some of you know Gladwell, the author who writes regularly for the New Yorker. And he has an article about violence. And he analyzes these instances like Columbine and the shooting in the theater at the opening of Batman and, you know, what happened in Charleston. He analyzes the growing number of these crimes, often committed by young white boys with assault weapons, and they go into a theater where five times as many people as are sitting here, or 10 times, sitting in the dark watching a movie, are suddenly massacred. And he analyzes it, and he comes to, you know, what to me is a very chilling conclusion. Modern psychologists say that there's a spectrum of autism, and that there are many young men who have an autism that makes it impossible for them to read the emotional content of another person's face, their gesture, their person, that these young people just don't get it. They don't feel how other people feel. They're incapable of recognizing human emotions. And so, more and more, there's a tendency to say, this person is not a criminal, this person is ill. Okay. In Gladwell's article, he talks about a young man. I plan to read a little bit from it. Had a lot of notes. Malcolm Gladwell's article is called Thresholds of Violence, How School Shootings Catch On. These are my glasses to see everybody. Now I'm going to put on my glasses to read. When my ship comes in, I'll get progressives. These cost $10 each. The progressives cost about $500. Ah, there we go. On the evening of April 29th last year in the southern Minnesota town of Waseca, a woman was doing the dishes when she looked out of her kitchen window and saw a young man walking through her backyard, wearing a backpack, carrying a fast food bag, headed in the direction of the Mini Max storage facility next to her house, but something didn't seem right. Why was he going through her yard instead of using the sidewalk? And why was he walking through puddles and not around them? And he fiddled with the lock of Unit 129 as if he were trying to break in. I'll skip some of the narrative. She calls the police. The police interrogate him. He admits, I've stockpiled many bombs here. I'm making bombs. And I plan to blow up the school and kill the teachers and kill as many students as I can. But before I do that, I'm going to kill my parents. And then I plan to kill myself. Now, I want to take you back for a minute to what Dave shared with us from the New York Times. And I'll share a little bit later some stories of my own life. Imagine if I said that to four or five white policemen who stopped me. Yeah, in this locker here, I've stockpiled a lot of ammunition and bombs, and I plan to blow up the school and shoot my parents to death. Well, they kind of carry on a cordial conversation with this young man, and they take him to jail. They phone up his parents. And as you read through the article, you see that he's one of those people who's evaluated as not a sick guy particularly, just falling somewhere on the spectrum of autism and needs some psychiatric help. So he's released on probation and he's put into a therapeutic situation. Okay, I think I can live with that, but I hope you get my drift, and if you don't, let me unpack it. What's with all of these young white males who get assault weapons and plan out and then carry out the murder of people they do not know? What's that about? I'm supposing that it has something to do with seeing a society that's founded on genocide, and the persons who commit the genocide are rewarded with mansions on the hill, millions in the bank, and influence around the world, and there's no compunction. There's no penalty, there's no regret, there's no compunction. If we protest, why do you say Black Lives Matter? All lives matter. You are, or I am, or whoever is making that claim, is devaluing the victim of assault and battery, repeated victim of assault and battery. And if your deprecation of that person's cry of protest is successful, you have effectively deadened your own humanity. My thesis here, what I'm saying is that the escalation of crimes of violence, white upon white, by young men who are in the spectrum of autism, incapable of understanding, if I shoot you with an assault rifle, it hurts you. It hurts your family. It hurts the whole world. But I can't get that. I don't get that. Why don't I get that? What happened to my humanity? It was sacrificed at the altar of systemic racism. a disease is stealthy. You may have a disease that doesn't have a symptom. It's asymptomatic, or the symptoms are not recognized for what they are. Let us please recognize the symptom that's afoot here. The NRA's insistence that the more guns, the safer we are, when every statistic shows us the falsity of that notion. This is symptomatic of a disease that is overtaking our nation and overtaking our world. I am out of my comfort zone when I talk about Black Lives Matter. I'm able to get really angry and worked up. But I don't want to stay in my comfort zone if staying in my comfort zone makes me subject to sleepy-headedness, blindness, indifference, and lassitude. So I've stepped out of my comfort zone, and I'm asking you to do the same. As Unitarian Universalists, we have one identity, but as Americans, we have a different one. Let me say a little bit about that. As an African-American, I have had difficulty saluting the flag. And in high school, I stopped saluting the flag. It was noticed in assembly. I was sent to the principal's office. I was told if I didn't salute the flag, my name would be, it would be recorded in my record that I was insolent. And I said, put it in my record. They just bombed a church in Birmingham where children were killed and the killers were all exonerated of any blame. And when I am supposed to say the words freedom and justice for all, I refuse to do it. When I look at American history, I see the genocide of the native peoples. I see the Trail of Tears. I see egregious misuse of human power. And I see our land dotted with concentration camps where people who are so traumatized and abused are living out a nightmare of criminal behavior against them. I see a Holocaust of Africans who came across the sea in ships, some of them my ancestors, most of whom didn't get across the sea, but were jettisoned or died in the holds of the ships, or were killed as they struggled against the nightmare of being abducted by hostile, strange-looking, strange-behaving people. I was enculturated around whites. My parents deliberately sent me to schools where my teachers were white and all the other students were white. It was difficult for me to understand that I was black, but there were people that were willing to help me. I encountered them. And at a certain point in my teens, I actually grappled with the fact that my mother, my black mother, said to me, "You're too white." "Mom, how could you say that? What are you talking about?" And I found myself, you know, listening to Lightning Hopkins and going to see Muddy Waters and kind of reclaiming my black heritage. Because in the process of making me safe, my parents also made me estranged from the culture that is so despised and so at risk in America. But America wouldn't let me remain in that position. For example, I'm a grandfather now. I've got 6 grandkids. But when I was 16, I was photographing some kids on a city street in New York, where I'm from originally. The kids had built a clubhouse. It was a Sunday afternoon. I was an aspiring visual artist. I was working with one of the deans of African-American photography, Roy D. Carava. I was in a workshop with Roy and other very gifted photographers. And I was photographing the clubhouse. And unseen by me, a white policeman walked up behind me and said, "You kids, get off this lot." And I saw, and I thought, oh, better get off the lot. So I started to walk off the lot. I guess I wasn't walking fast enough. I felt a really hard kick in my butt. And as I spun around, I felt a second really hard kick in my thigh. And I was incensed. I said, you've just broken the law. You're not going to get away with it. Then he took his stick and he battered me with it. I almost fell down. And then I immediately remembered something. A black kid, my age grade, same town, that same summer, was shot to death. His name was James Powell. And the police officer said later, well, I thought the youth had a gun. He didn't have a gun. Well, I thought the youth had a gun. I didn't feel safe. Man was exonerated of any crime. I want you to feel for a minute. I hope I'm not talking to people whose spectrum of autism. I know I'm not, because you're UUs. Can you imagine the grief of his parents? Have you raised children, or do you have a relative who's raised a child? I've raised three children. I have six grandchildren. Every child, you just give them everything you have. You pray, you hope, you wish, you struggle, you sacrifice. What happened to James? What? Do you think the mother ever recovers? I tell you, the mother never recovers. The father never recovers. But it went through my mind, and I shut up. I was trembling with rage, but I tried to conceal it. We got off the lot. He walked up the street. I told the kids he's not going to get away with it. I crossed the street. I walked very fast in the same direction he was going, but on the opposite side of a four-lane thoroughfare. And when I was sufficiently ahead of him, I crossed back over and I walked towards him as he leisurely walked up the street. And I deliberately encountered him for the second time on a crowded and busy gas station, where people were pumping gas and doing all sorts of business. I took his photograph several times. I got close enough to write down his badge number. And then I had the cheek to ask him, could he change a dollar? I wanted to make a phone call. At that point, he exploded into expletives. And everybody in the gas station stopped, which is what I was counting on. He wouldn't shoot me to death in front of all these people for asking him for change. When I got on the bus to go home, I was trembling with so much rage that people stood back from me. They got 10 or 15 feet away from me as soon as they looked at my face. I was trembling with rage. Long story short, we took him to trial. It was a police trial. It was closed. My parents were affluent by that time. I was born in the ghetto, but my parents had become affluent by that time. We had a very good lawyer. Policeman says, oh, I never saw the youth. I don't know what this is about. I never saw him in my life. And the lawyer introduced the photographs I took. Well, maybe I saw the youth, but I never touched him. The photographs that my doctor took of the contusions on my butt and thighs were introduced. Oh, well, maybe I touched the youth, but I just gently took him by the elbow off the lot because I was afraid he'd fall on the broken glass. Braverman, the police officer, was put off the force for 2 months without pay, and it went on his record that he assaulted and battered me. After that, my interest in visual arts declined. And my interest in why do people behave this way? What's going on? What hope is there for human beings? What safety is there? That's kind of when the call to ministry awakened in me and the call to humanitarian work. But that's another story. I've been assaulted and battered twice. That's one I won't bore you with details of the second time. Both cases, the crime was being black. I'm not yet at third base. I'm rounding second. Hang in there, folks. How many people, if I say Black Wall Street, it rings a bell for you? Ooh. Gee, I was hoping there'd be more. Seriously, it's recent history. Okay, let me put another question to you, and then I'll bring it together. When was the first time that there was a significant air raid on American soil and bombing of American homes and death rained from the sky on American citizens? What was the first date of such an event? Well, you know because you raised your hand. Say it again. Hmm? When? What year? The right answer came from, is your name John? Did I hear? Yes, John, who spoke earlier and urged everybody to go on Wednesday. Please do. 1921, June 1st. Black Wall Street was destroyed in 27 hours. Let me read you some of the details here. First of all, Oklahoma was meant to be a state for Indian, Native Americans, and blacks. That was the original idea. And part of that is because the Trail of Tears was walked by Africans in diaspora and Indians. Hmm? So Greenwood was a suburb of Tulsa. Greenwood was dubbed Black Wall Street. And on June 1st, there was a bombing of the city, the neighborhood. And the whole thing was razed, brought to the ground. What was there? It was all black. And these were enterprising blacks, some of whom had come back from the First World War. There were grocery stores, clothing stores, barber shops, banks, hotels, cafes, movie theaters, two newspapers, and homes. I'm looking at the long form. I wanted the short form. Here it is. 21 churches, 21 restaurants, 30 grocery stores, 2 movie theaters, a hospital, a bank, a post office, library, schools, law offices. Half a dozen private airplanes were owned by black residents of Black Wall Street. It was a very affluent city. In fact, it was much more affluent than their counterparts in the white area, especially the returning veterans. Why? The affluence because Jim Crow laws made it impossible for the black people to do business with white people, so the money stayed in the community, and it circulated dozens of times through the hands of the people there, so it became a robust economy. One doctor, for example, Dr. Berry, guess what his average daily income was in 1920? One or two guesses? I can't hear you. Oh, that's an overestimate, I'll tell you. But daily, I'm saying daily in 1921, an African American. That's an underestimate. One more? No, $500 a day. There was a lot of envy. The low-end estimate is that 300 people were killed. The high-end estimate is 3,000. I tend to believe it's the higher. Hmm? Even Dave, when you were talking about, it was John, I think you were talking about, the incarceration, the arrest and harassment of blacks for possessing or dealing in marijuana has seemingly increased a lot. I was wondering, has it really increased, or has scrutiny revealed that more has happened? Now, it may be, as you suggest, that there's been an escalation of persecution and prosecution. But in either case, there's something wrong. Something smells very bad there. So what happened is that whole town was destroyed. Now, this is one of the pogroms. But if you go online and you look up legitimate and reliable sources, you find that whenever black communities begin to thrive, or black individuals begin to thrive, there's a concerted effort to destroy. Thousands of people were driven out of their homes. Mass graves were made, and people's bodies were shoved into those graves. It's more likely that there were thousands of people killed that day. And this is not an isolated instance. I will mention one nation that has suffered the same fate, and suggest to you that this is also not isolated. What is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere? Haiti. How many times have American military forces intervened in Haiti? Do you know? Hmm? No. Many times more. As many as 20 times. Whenever Haiti's infrastructure began to become robust, healthy, and self-reliant, American forces went in to loot, plunder, terrorize, and destroy. There's a reason that Haiti is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, because it was the second country that had a successful revolution against an oppressive government overseas. America did it, and a few years later, Haiti did it. America defeated the British, the Haitians defeated the French. But in our Congress, the N-word fills the congressional record when there's reference to the freed women and men of Haiti. And the hostility was palpable. And the military incursions were meant to demonstrate the inferiority of blacks, the incapability of blacks to do anything. And so even today, even I, as a black man, or you as white people, are probably encrypted with the notion, well, yeah, that's why Haiti is that way, because the people just, they just don't have what it takes. And if Black Wall Street wasn't bombed to the ground, we'd have a different encryption, just from paying attention. This is how the diatribe of white supremacy works. It's reinforced by terrorist activities. Black Lives Matter, because if we don't pay attention to the fact that there are pogroms regularly held against black individuals and communities, that a black person who makes a minor infraction is likely to be killed for it, whereas a white person who shoots to death a black person in broad daylight for no reason at all is likely to get a wrist slap or exoneration. One more point on this, and then I'm rounding third base now. I'm getting to the good points, okay? McGraw-Hill, big publisher, right? Textbook, World Geography. Where is it? In schools all across America. Where is it made? Texas. And who are the board of people who review the contents? More than 20 PhDs. You know, highly qualified, highly educated people, credentialed. PhDs. Turn to the section on patterns of immigration. And what do you read? You read about all the different groups that came to America. You read Africans came to America as workers. Hello? Well, if you can successfully teach that to all the children, and you can show them how, look, these people, they don't dress so nicely. They speak in a crude way. They're vulgar. They yell at their kids a whole lot. See? They're inferior. I mean, they came here as workers, but they've never raised themselves up. They never have prospered like we have. It's because they're intrinsically inferior. Do you know how many years I believed that as a black man? Do you know how many years I believed that? Do you know that I still struggle with that? And I know that that's false. This is what Black Lives Matter is asking each of us to do. Maybe caucus, whites and blacks, get together and talk about the encryptions that are crippling us and illusioning us so that our behavior doesn't match the need of the times. We're all encrypted with racist diatribe. We're all hampered in our humanity as a result. And people are stockpiling assault weapons, and they're getting further and further on the spectrum of autism, not feeling, not knowing, capable of the most egregious crimes. And then they're not criminals. They're simply sick people that need therapy. Well, it's a sick nation that needs therapy. And when somebody's behavior is that dangerous and antisocial, they need to be quarantined. And we need to get to the root cause. Okay, so I got to look at my thesis again. I'm getting worked up. And that's not good. Okay, here's where, you know, I'm rounding third base, getting close to home now. The problem is basically a spiritual problem and not a material problem. The manifestation is in the material realm. It plays out. the segregation, the apartheid, the lynchings, the terrorism. That's all material stuff. But its ideology, its origin, is in spiritual misapprehension, spiritual misunderstanding. What am I talking about? Let me unpack it. You have a picture of yourself when you were 3. You're 70. You're showing it to your grandchild. And you say, that's a picture of me when I was 3.
3-year-old, 67-year-old,
70-year-old. Every cell in the body is changed. That's a picture of me. Well, it's a picture of the body, but that body doesn't exist anymore. Let's look at it another way. The famous words, they weren't exactly politically correct, but all men are created equal. And it's a self-evident truth that all men are created equal. It should have been all humans, okay. But there's a little back there in time. What's that about? The young man who's going away tomorrow, if we did an arm wrestle, he'd beat me every time. We're not equal in strength. He's more well-built than I am, more athletic. He's a strong man. There are short men and tall men. There are very witty men, and there are people whose intelligence functions in different ways. They may have another form of genius and talent, but it's not intellectual brilliance. On a material platform, nobody is created equal. There's all inequality. So Jefferson's statement, the founding father's notion, that was a spiritual notion. One more attempt at lodging the idea what the misapprehension is. Say that a criminal is put in jail for a 40-year sentence, and after 10 years, they die. What is done with the body? Well, it's taken out, and it's buried or it's cremated. It's not held in prison for another 30 years. Why? Because he's gone. What do you mean he's gone? There's the body. The material shell is still there. But the criminal or the person who's supposed to be penitent is no longer there because the person is a spiritual being. This is the difference between material and spiritual. And I'm not talking theism now. I'm talking phenomena that we can recognize. We say, my arm, my head, my body. That means I possess it. I am distinct from it. Spirit and matter are distinct. We are spiritual beings. Racism denies that we're spiritual beings. Racism and the systems of apartheid and terrorism and oppression, they are predicated on the fact that if I do an injustice and I gain from it, I have won something. But spiritual phenomena shows us anytime we disrupt our positive affect, we go into the circle of shame. There's always a consequence for evil doing and wrongdoing for a spiritual being. Again, I connect it to the assault weapons that are being stockpiled and the kids who can't read emotions and who have access to all these guns and ammunition. The problem is spiritual. The solution is spiritual. However you do it, you could do it like Sam Harris, the famous atheist who wrote Open Letter to a Christian Nation and Beyond Faith. The End of Faith. Thank you. I read both books, but thank you for the name. But Sam Harris advocates that there is a kind of mystical reality. He's interested in Far Eastern iterations of it, and he gets into that. It could be from a theistic angle. It could be from any kind of angle whatsoever that we discover the nature of our spirituality and the consequences of being a moral and ethical person, a person susceptible to remorse, or when we shut those things off, what are the consequences? Now, the final thing I want to say, Unitarian Universalists have always gotten this. That's been the trademark or the characteristic of our tradition. We're heretics. That means we question things. That's what heresy means. We want to know. What do you mean we're intrinsically evil and that we can't lift ourselves out of evil? What does that mean? We don't have agency, but we do have agency. We can make choices, and they're very consequential. We face being burned at the stake for making that claim. We recognize that women have a right to property, to education, to autonomy, to divorce. They're full human beings, not chattel. But until less than 100 years ago, women couldn't vote. But we were way ahead of that. Abolition, way ahead of it. We're heretical and we're transgressive. Knowledge is transgressive. If you want to know something, you have to go beyond where you are. You transgress the boundaries. And you go into territory that's unknown, and you become rich by it. So what I'm saying is that the malady in America is the conception that we're material units meant to consume. Our purpose is to acquire as many possessions as we can and exhaust whatever pleasure they hold, and then we cease to be. If that were true, you can't show a picture of yourself when you were three and say to your grandchild, "This is a picture of me." Because you're showing a picture of the body, and the body is not you. So we have known this, the transcendentalist movement, the free pulpit, the free pew, these are all testament to our acknowledgement of spirituality and its worth. And the courage to be a heretic, the courage to be transgressive, the courage to go inside and look at the encryptions. I've been encrypted with, "I can't lead. I can't hold forth. I'm less. And I have to extirpate it. And I do. I'm not less. I can lead. I am brilliant." What have you been encrypted with? That's the task that lies before us as Unitarian Universalists. I heard with great joy your call, John. And I think what John Alou and Jill and Sarah and I are doing is saying, next time, let us know, and we'll be there on Wednesday. Some of the people from my congregation and some of the people from Topeka, outside agitators, will come and agitate from outside. This is a global village. There's no more ring to that. There's no more truth to outside agitators. We're all in this. We're on that limb. The saw is acting. The prophet has spoken. Are we going to get on the right side of the limb, or are we going to go down with a thud? Thank you very much.
The final hymn that we'll sing this morning, it's a frequent accompaniment at wakes and at memorials, but this morning's service is neither. I'm offering this song to highlight two events that have taken place. One is the play Amazing Grace is closing today in New York City after just a four-month run. And the second is more relevant, is the writing of Amazing Grace by a fellow named John Newton. He was an 18th century Britisher who began in the family business of slave trading, but due to personal and ethical challenges, he left the family business. He became an Anglican minister and a staunch early abolitionist. So it is in the spirit of Mr. Newton's conversion that we sing this hymn. So please join me in number 205, Amazing Grace.
Lost, but now.
Thank you. Thank you, David. And please join us for coffee out in the Narthex.